So I'm not quite sure how tonight's talk is going to go. Sometimes, you know, I lead about 10 to 15 different mindfulness groups a week, and this is what I do primarily for a living. And so sometimes you end up giving the talk that you need to hear just because you need to put in the room, you know, something that has been relevant or something that I've been working with. And so tonight I want to talk about the topic of renunciation and the theme of the art of giving up and the joy of letting go. There's a really simple quote that this meditation master named Ajahn Chah offered. He says, if you let go a little, you get a little bit of freedom. You let go a lot, you get a lot of freedom. If you let go completely, you get complete freedom. It's really a simple message that the Buddha offered, which is in order to experience freedom or more ease in our lives, we have to learn to let go of the things that don't serve that freedom. So we have to practice this very elusive idea of letting go of what's getting in the way of that freedom. But in order to let go of the things that don't serve our freedom, we have to see them for what they are. We have to see them as obstacles to our own freedom. We have to see these things as painful, distressing, suffering. Oftentimes, the things that I think are contributing to my happiness or comfort or making me feel good are, in effect, actually getting in the way of, you know, the less base levels of pleasure, you know, the more deep levels of joy, welfare. So the problem is that these obstacles to our freedom or health and well-being are often in familiar clothes, you know, stylish clothes or things that we are allured into, that are seductive, that are familiar, that are comfortable. Old relationships, we get into the same relationships. We get into the same relationships with our finances, with money, the same financial insecurities, the same addictive cycles. You know, we do these things and they happen subtly and they happen, you know, oftentimes unconsciously. We're not so aware that that's where we end up. And so they're familiar, and it's like wearing a familiar shirt. It feels nice. You know, even if it has holes in it, it's not keeping us warm any longer. We like to wear it because we know it, right? And so we have to, as the Buddha encouraged, we have to actually learn to be honest and to tell the truth about the ways we experience stress and suffering in our lives. We have to actually start to sit down and to inquire, to practice a contemplative practice of reflecting on what is not serving my freedom, my health, my well-being. And Buddhism can sometimes get a bad rep. It sounds a little bit pessimistic, a little bit nihilistic. We're always talking about suffering in here, right? So I think it's important that we have to remember that the looking at the distress in our lives is really looking at what's getting in the way. Like Carl Jung says, we don't awaken by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious. We have to look at the things that lead to our well-being. And this is what we do with the practice of mindfulness, is we develop self-awareness. We look at the mind and we sit and we see its motivations and its underlying tendencies. What does the mind want? Well, it wants to feel good. It wants me to feel good. It wants me to feel validation. I want to gain and acquire. I want to be praised. I want to feel pleasure. The mind has a very base level of this kind of need. And we have to, in a sense, kind of confront our own humanity. And we'll talk about this a little bit later on, about these kind of underlying motivations of our brain. But I like this psychological interpretation. Again, Carl Jung says, and he uses male pronoun so we can translate internally. But he says, if you imagine someone who is brave enough to withdraw all his projections, then you get an individual who is conscious of a pretty thick shadow. Such a man has saddled himself with new problems and conflicts. He has become a serious problem to himself, and he is now unable to say that they do this or that, they are wrong, they must be fought against. Such a man knows that whatever is wrong in the world is in himself, and if he only learns to deal with his own shadow, he has done something real for the world. He has succeeded in shouldering at least an infinitesimal part of the gigantic, unresolved social problems of our day. I like this idea that whatever is wrong in the world is wrong, or can be found in myself, right? Whatever is wrong in the world can be found in myself. This idea of confronting, the Buddhists would say, greed, hatred, and delusion, which are very strong words. Yeah, but we're confronting and we're actually taking responsibility for how we move out, how we engage in our relationships, how I engage internally, how I engage externally, and how I have a relationship between my internal world and the external world, and the ways that that's not really working out. And I love that he says we have to become a big problem to ourselves. That's kind of the idea of Buddhist practice, is to question the self. You know, have you noticed, Brené Brown calls this the inner hustler, the part of the mind that needs to prove and predict and compare and compete and outperform. And, you know, all the ways that the greed and the hatred and the subtle levels of competitiveness and separation and isolation and shame. And, you know, there's so much nuance to the stress of the mind. And we go into the basement, we take out the light of mindfulness and we shine it. You know, shine it in the places that we don't want to look ordinarily. We sit down and you get whatever you get. And so I think in one sense, it's the most courageous thing that we can do is to just sit down and be willing to sit quietly for 30 minutes with whatever comes up. And sometimes it's like the tidal wave of all the things I've been running through have just come crashing down on me. And sometimes it's quite easeful and quite peaceful and quite relaxing. But there's this kind of quest. And one of the discourses in the Buddha's discourses, the Pali Canon, is called the Noble Quest. And there's this quest to search and to seek. And there's a little bit of responsibility around this. Like, no one is going to do this work for me. No one's going to look into my own mind and look at my own motivations for how I act and speak. And, you know, I've got to do that. I've got to do the work. And it's really easy to not do the work. It's really easy to go with the stream, right? The stream of these kind of underlying, I want, I don't want, I like, I don't like, my preferences, my stream of preferences. I talked about last week this quote that the Buddha offered, that beings, human beings, are the owners of their actions, the heirs of their actions, spring from their actions, and are bound to their actions. Human beings are supported by their actions. In whatever ways we act, we fall heir. That we're always practicing something. And we know this with neuroscience, that we have plasticity of the mind, that we have thinking is a behavior. How I spend my time up here gets reinforced. What I look for, I find a lot of the time. And to take some responsibility for the mind and to take care of the mind. So I find this to be, this letting go is a process more of letting in than letting go. You know, it means to sit down and it means to spend time with the parts of myself, the shadow parts of myself, and the parts of myself that ordinarily I don't want to spend time with, and to learn to see the stress, and to learn to hold the stress, and to learn to care for the stress of my body and my mind. there are these two seemingly paradoxical or kind of dialectical stances of the Buddhist practice. On one hand, we're cultivating and we're developing things that are wholesome. So we're practicing kindness and compassion, non-harming. We're practicing looking for and delighting in joy and developing appreciation and gratitude. And we're really exercising the mind to practice. That we have this myth of authenticity culturally that I need to feel something first. But it's really more than that. It's this looking for and practicing these emotional qualities of goodwill. So there's this cultivation. I talked about the field last week and how we plant seeds and we tend to the field and we nurture the field and we always grow something. And so there's this cultivating aspect of we have to plant the seeds that we want to grow, and we have to actually learn to pick the fruit of the seeds that we grow. And we have to, this other thing, this other end of renunciation, we have to learn to let go of the seeds and the fruit that's not sustaining or nourishing us. We have to, even if we grow it, learn to let it die on the vine. You know, and sometimes we get so hungry and the seeds that we planted are so close to us, we don't want to go way out and to the field of the, you know, we don't want to tend to the new seeds. We just pick the ones that have already developed, that are already ripe and they're here, even though they're not nourishing us. It's kind of this relationship between cultivation and renunciation. And in talking about renunciation, I think for me, this path of practice, mindfulness, everything that we're doing here really feels a lot like letting go of what's getting in the way of my happiness, health, and well-being instead of adding something. It feels a lot more subtractive than additive. Sharon Salzberg says, "We can travel a long way and do many different things, but our deepest happiness is not born from accumulating new experiences. It is born from letting go of what is unnecessary and knowing ourselves to be always at home. True happiness may not be all that far away, but it requires a radical change of view as to where to find it." And the Western mind is so captivated with activity, with doing. You know, what's the next thing? We have even this phrase that I use with the adolescents I work with a lot, FOMO, the fear of missing out, right? And so there's this kind of constant chronic doing, and we don't even know what we're doing a lot of the times. We just got to do something. And so we do and we do. And I love that she says, our deepest happiness is not born from accumulating new experiences. It's born from letting go of what's unnecessary and knowing ourselves to always be at home. And this is the repetitive cycle of craving. This is the repetitive cycle of the anxiety and the subtle desire of the human condition. You know, the restlessness and the insecurity and the vulnerability of what it means to be human. And so we run around trying to find ways to cope. How do I find ground in a groundless existence? You know, how do I find stability in an unstable life? And we end up finding proximate security, things that give us a sense of rest, respite, refuge. And this letting go, this process of subtracting away and relinquishing all of this, the Buddha calls getting caught up in this and that, the grab and drop. I gotta have this, I wanna have that, the if only this, then that, if once I get the thing and then I get the that, and once I get rid of this thing, then I get that. That kind of process that is repetitive, that's not going anywhere, that, you know, what we're learning to do is we're learning to uncover our natural capacity to be with the more vulnerable aspects of being human. We're learning to uncover our ability to be with the pleasure and pain and the gain and the loss and the equal beauty and tragedy of life, that life is both. And so why do we try to deny? Why is the strategy to deny the tragedy and to deny the loss and to deny the pain? How do we open to these parts of our experience that are very human and very tragic and also very beautiful at the same time? And he describes the meditative practice as a very slow, patient uncovering. He describes it like stumbling into the jungle, into almost like an archaeological dig site, a site of a ruin that's been overgrown with vines and it's been eroded and dirt's been covering it, and that you got to go in there and excavate the dig site, that the qualities or our capacity to care for our pain, the capacity to meet ourselves and hold ourselves amidst our vulnerability and distress, that that's already in there. We know how to do that. And that just takes the work of uncovering that. And oftentimes our primary woundings, experiences in life keep us from doing the work, because I'm afraid what I'm going to find when I get down there. Because I'm going to find the 12-year-old that got cast out. I'm going to find the abuse. I'm going to find the abandonment, the betrayal, the shame. And so we cover it up and we cover it up and we cover it up. And so where do we start? I mean, this is all very abstract and these are just my own reflections and thoughts. And where we start, I think, is very simple. I think it's just slowing down. I think learning how to take time out of our day. I talk to people all the time about starting a meditation practice. And one of the things about starting a meditation practice is, again, it's very subtractive. It's not like you're actually adding something to your day. You're taking away time. You know, and so people are all like, I don't have time to do that. I don't have time. And it's like, you know, it's just sitting. It's just sitting. You don't have time to sit. You don't have time to walk and to know you're walking and know you're sitting. And I get it. You know, this is the activity. This is the hypervigilance of the mind to look for. It's so addicted to its own stress. I read this quote a lot. It's probably one of my favorites. It's by Milan Kundera. He says, "Speed, the demon of speed, is often associated with forgetting and with avoidance, and slowness with memory and confronting. We move slowly when we want to listen to ourselves. We move slowly when we want to listen to others in the world around us. We move slowly when we want to accept ourselves. The rush of contemporary life overwhelms us in our ability to observe, to hear, to stop, and to wonder. Society in its speed wants to blow out the tiny flame of memory." So what is this tiny flame of memory that's getting blown out by these activities and the speed? What we're forgetting is we're forgetting this. We're forgetting I'm here. We have this sense of time, and I have the thing that I'm doing now and the thing I'm doing next. And the mind has learned to lean into the thing that I'm doing next. And it creates the sense of leaning, and the leaning reinforced creates momentum, and it creates speed. The next thing, and this thing, and that thing. And then we're trying to schedule time for our own lives and all of the next things. And so this is what I think he talks about very beautifully, is he calls it the demon of speed. It's associated with forgetting and with avoidance. And what do we forget? We forget I'm here. This waking up is not a place. Enlightenment's not a thing, I don't think. Maybe it is. I don't really care. What I've found, the benefit from this practice, is I can wake up now. I can come back to being engaged and living in the full depth of the beauty and the tragedy, the full depth of the joy and the sorrow. And so, Milan Kundera also points to society and its speed. So there's this kind of cultural reinforcement. There's, we get caught up in the speed because it's the nature of our own mind. And like Carl Jung said, we see the world internally in ourselves, right? And so there's this relationship. We reinforce our environments. Our environments reinforce how we feel and experience the world internally. And so the first place to start in practicing renunciation, the word in Pali Sanskrit for renunciation is nikama, which means something kind of like not needing anything extra. And the place to start is always in looking at the outer forms of how I can simplify. If I can simplify my external environment, and I can simplify in my behavior, my direct action, a lot of times the mind itself starts to slow down. A lot of time the mind itself can start to quiet. We can find some of the stillness, and we can find some of the the access to our own heart, what we're uncovering, our emotional intelligence. The mind body as a system knows how to heal its own wounds. And we're born in empathy. We have mirror neurons in our brain. We know how to feel with. That's what empathy is. We feel with. But we need to slow down to access that, because out of fear I run around, out of insecurity I run around. But if I can slow down, I can start to access and to feel with my life. I can feel with the relationships. I can start to open. And so we start with our environment. I think this outer form of renunciation is looking, as the Buddha encouraged, one of the areas to look into is our who we associate with, our communities, our friends, the people we spend our time around. So the question kind of for reflection, for my own reflection and yours, are there social connections that you have in your life that make our commitment to personal welfare particularly challenging? Are there connections that I have in my life that make my commitment to doing this work hard? Just kind of noticing and noting what those relationships are. We're social creatures. We're so influenced by the environments that we find ourselves in. So if I spend my time around people that aren't interested in doing this work, it's easy to be influenced in that way. Associating with the wise. We'll talk about this kind of relationship between the outer and the inner. But that's, I think, a good reflection, is our friendships, our communities, and also our environment in the form of what we consume. What things do we consume in our environments that initially feel good but ultimately create disease? I have a list of these. The things that I engage in, or the kind of simple habits, or so just kind of looking at what places do I frequent and with what people do I frequently engage with. That's a good way to look at that, is like the people and the places that I am accustomed to, that I'm floating around in. I watched this movie last night called Ingrid Goes West. Have any of you all seen this movie? It's insane. It's about social media, and it's about this kind of like sense of finding ourselves, performing ourselves to the world, and kind of reacting to each other's performances, and how that can be very connecting, but that can also be very chaotic. And looking at that environment as technology increases, I mean, we have to really be on guard and be careful about how much time we spend engaging in these systems of communication, of stimulation. And changing our behavior, renunciation around how I act, how I behave. That's something that I definitely have a lot of agency over. And it's one of the most beautiful aspects of our humanity is that we can act our way towards more freedom. In 12-step recovery, they teach a lot of times you can act your way into right thinking, but it's harder to think your way into right acting. And I actually kind of buy that. The good thing about behavior is you can do it. You don't even have to believe it. You don't even have to feel like doing it. You can do it. And one of the behaviors that we're really looking at practicing is the behavior of generosity. It's what the Buddha talked about before anything else. He talked about when any person would come up to him and say, hey, what's the most advanced meditation practice I can do? What's the quickest, most direct path to freedom? He said, you know, be of service. Look for opportunities to be of service. And to do that from a place not of obligation, to do that from a place not of expectation, but to do that from a place of connection. There's no way to feel better that I've found that's lasting, that has an impact other than being of service. I almost never feel bad after I do something from a place of no expectation, no obligation. I'm just here for you. I support you. I'll do this for you. Doing service just brightens the mind. And behavior in the sense of if you've been coming for a while, this practice of sila, which is the kind of behavioral or ethical aspect of the Buddha's teaching, which is looking at relating to my speech, my action, and how I live and work in the world in a wise and accountable and healthy way. So bringing our attention into these fields of speech, these fields of action are kind of the more direct behavior, and then the field of money and work. Again, really great opportunity to clear up some of the extra activity and chaos of my life just by looking at simplifying how I speak and how I act and how I work. If you look at the training precepts, these are these trainings that we invite ourselves to look at in Buddhist practice. There are five of them. They're all formulated in this subtractive language of refraining. Not doing something, but practicing refraining from certain behaviors. The first is refraining from intentionally causing harm to any living beings. Not as a moral code, not as a commandment, but as a contemplative practice. All right, Andrew, today I wake up, I undertake this training to refrain from intentionally causing harm to any living beings. What would that look like? In its biggest, highest aspiration, what would that look like? And what would be a stretch for me today? You know? Refraining from taking what's not freely offered. Again, renunciation, one of its purest forms, is how often do I take and consume and kind of go after things that aren't really, you know, being offered. And part of this is living simply. Part of this topic of renunciation came into my mind because I'm about to go sit at a monastery for a month in Myanmar. And I've been on retreat before, and I was reflecting on how different my life is in this world than on retreat, especially when you spend a couple weeks or a month on retreat, how little I need to survive when I'm on retreat. This is what made me come up with this topic today. I went into my toiletry bag, and I didn't have this face lotion that I use because my skin's really dry. And I was like, I need to get some of that before I go to Myanmar. And then I thought, when I end up on retreat, I never end up using any of this stuff that I bring. You know, when I am on retreat, I need to eat and I need to have a bed. And that's kind of it. You know, the preferences for all of the little things, you know, in this practice of looking at what is really needed, what are my kind of essential needs to get through my life. And again, what is the highest aspirational area or field of that? Maybe if you wanted to be a monk and be a monastic. And then what's stretching it a little bit for me? And refraining from unskillful sexual engagement, you know, in whatever forms that takes, our relationship to masturbation, to sexual intercourse, to sexual attraction, to objectification, to pornography, to all of these things. Again, not as moral codes, watching our kind of Western conditioning around sex. We don't talk about this in public spaces, and there are good forms of sex and bad forms of sex, and this kind of, but looking at this as a training is what's harmful and unskillful in regard to how I engage in my sexuality. Because all human beings have sexuality, whether they act on it or not, whether it's an absence of sexual desire or a field of sexual desire. So looking at our relationship to that, and looking at refraining from divisive, dishonest, manipulative, harsh speech, refraining from intoxicating substances that lead to carelessness, all the things, again, that I consume. And so these are things that we can look at. And it's great because on the outer environment, I can do that. I can do that. I can actually guard my heart and mind by tending to the fields of who I associate with, how I engage in the places that I, in the fields of exchange and this kind of capitalist sense of where I go and where I buy and who I see and who I spend time with, and then also my behavior, how I meet the outer world with my actions. But really realizing at the ultimate level that it's not those things that cause my distress. It's my relationship to those things, right? That the real work is this kind of inner relationship to how we relate to external people, places, and things. And so I want to offer this before I open it up because I think it's very important. There's a neuroscientist named Melvin Connor who studied the human nervous system. And his research indicates that the motivational portions of the brain, the human brain, particularly the hypothalamus, have characteristics relevant to the apparent chronic nature of human dissatisfaction. Experiments suggest that our chronic internal state, the state of the human nervous system, will be a vague mixture of anxiety and desire, best described by the phrase, "I want," spoken with or without an object for the verb. So what he's saying is we have a sense of this vague mixture of anxiety and desire, a sense of inner restlessness and craving. And it can be subtle and it can be intense. Right? I notice this sometimes when I'm standing around waiting in line to get a coffee and wanting something, right? And not even knowing what I want. I already know what I'm going to order, but I want, and I'll go to my phone or I go you know, to Facebook, or I, you know, go pick up a magazine, or this kind of. So one of the senses of renunciation is looking at how we engage with what they call sense craving. Craving through sight and smell and taste and sound and feeling, how we go through our senses to try to relinquish or relax some of this inner restlessness, this vague mixture of anxiety and desire. And really, if we look at this, it can almost be overwhelming how much restlessness and how much kind of craving through the senses that we experience. And I think an important aspect of this, and the beauty of this being a research study, is that it's not our fault. This is actually what the brain is designed to do. Because a long time ago, the brain learned to equate pleasure and comfort with happiness, safety, and security. You know, if I eat a donut, high caloric intake, I get rewarded for eating the donut. Because when I needed to gather berries or, you know, whatever, and I wouldn't eat for 2 or 3 days, whatever was high in calorie felt really good and had to release a lot of dopamine, so I would do it again. But now I can get donuts 24/7. right? That are with the increase of our technology, that we there are ample opportunities to feel and feed the senses. There are ample opportunities to, you know, take in the world through our senses. And again, it's not these things in and of themselves that are the issue. It's that sense of needing or having to have, or this kind of addiction that we create around all of these things. The habits, even the most nuanced, subtle habits that we fall into. What am I going to do tonight? Well, I'm going to go home. You know, I'm going to watch Netflix. I watch 2 episodes of this every night. You know, this is kind of like, we just kind of fall into these habits. And again, it's not bad, but it's something to look at. So internally, what we do is we're able to develop more of a capacity to hold our craving and restlessness. We're able to watch that our craving and restlessness, it comes and it wells up and it gets intense and it passes. And that each opportunity that I have to sit with the welling up of my own restlessness and craving that I don't act on, that I learn to develop that capacity to sit with that craving. I learn distress tolerance, which is a huge aspect of mindfulness. It's not the most fun thing to talk about, but sitting still and noticing the itch and, you know, all right, I'll sit with the itch a little bit. You know, I'll let that feeling of that itch or that pain or that discomfort, can I sit with that? Can I open to that? Can I relax around that? And it will well up and it will come and it will go. It will die down. And I like to look at this as letting something be, much more than letting something go. As far as our internal meditative practice, I can let go of behaviors and actions and things I participate in, relationships that aren't serving me. I can actually set boundaries from those things. But my mind is not going to stop craving. My mind is not going to stop wanting to feel good and feel pleasure all of the time and to feel comfortable, right? But I can let those parts of me be. I can learn to tolerate them, and I can learn to see them for what they are, and I can learn to develop a pause or a space that I react to, you know, and relate to these parts of myself and develop this, you know, ability to hold or to be with. And when you're able to be with something over and over again, it kind of stops bothering you so much because it's not getting reinforced. It's like my dog, when my dog wants to go outside, or during daylight savings time, my dog wanted to eat dinner an hour early and would whine and whine and whine and whine and whine and whine. And the day in and day out, I'm trained in dialectical behavioral therapy, so I'm always thinking about not behaviorally reinforcing things I don't want to reinforce. So sitting with the whining and sitting with the whining and sitting with the whining, he was able to learn how to wait that extra hour, right? And to get on a new schedule. We can do that. And we can do that with the parts of our mind that are the most distressing. Because the mind is urgent, and it will tell you that you have to do it now. And sometimes we just do it. That's okay. But sometimes we can sit with that and watch the urgency of the mind and say, you know what, dude, I think I'm okay. I don't think I'm going to die if my knee hurts a little bit right now. And the mind screams, are you sure you're not going to die? Like, no, I think I'm... And that's the difference between the first arrow and the second arrow. There's the pain, and then there's my mind's dramatic reaction to the pain. Move right now. And what we have agency over is the second arrow, the mind's reaction. Oh, I see you, mind. It's okay. The pain's there, yes, but it's all right. So letting be over and over again develops this equanimity, the ability to be with our experience without having to push or pull on it, without having to suppress our emotions and sensations, but not having to pull and get enmeshed in them. Last thing I want to share is letting go is really hard. There are patterns and there are ways of operating that we have learned that are going to continue to visit us over and over and over again. There are ways that we've learned to operate that aren't going anywhere anytime soon. You know, and oftentimes when we learn to start to relax a little bit around these, you know, patterns of craving and clinging, when we learn to relax a little bit, these, we start to confront the fear. You know, why do I hold on to something? Well, because I'm afraid that if I was to let it go, that I would have to experience something else. So a lot of times when I, you know, start to dive into my meditation practice, you start to confront what's underneath anxiety, you know, what's underneath some of these behaviors that I'm running to. And when I start to let go of the relationships or the things that aren't serving me, then I have to deal with the sadness or the loneliness or the fear of the thing that's underneath. And so we have to have support. We have to have accountability. Mindfulness isn't enough. Therapy is a great addition. You know, we have to do the heart practices. It's a holistic path, right? There are all, the Buddha offered a path of 8 different fields of practice. And we have to ultimately just keep showing up with courage, with patience, with an incredible amount of grace for ourselves, because we're not going to do it right. There's actually no way to do it right. We just got to do it. We just got to show up, and we got to do the work.